I said, I'm going to tell you what I tell every group of people I get a chance to talk to when it's a gathering of LGBT folks. And it's, I'm sorry. I'm sorry because it took me too long, and it did. Because that story happened in 96. So you take that story and you just multiply it by, 100. And, things began to shift.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning in for another episode with us here at The Voices. Gary here, flying solo today. And I guess first just have to say some thank you. So we've got a few more patrons on Patreon. And so it's pretty exciting that our show's grown. People are supporting it and finding what we're doing valuable. So hope you are enjoying finding this as a resource. That being said, we do have some other ideas cooking up for other ways that we can be a resource to you on your spiritual journey. Other than just sitting and listening to a podcast, we'd like to get a little more creative with that. So stay tuned, be on the lookout for those kinds of things. I just thanks for listening and being a part of the show. We really appreciate it and love the community that's developing around this work that Kyle and I just said, hey, let's try something new and just go for it and see what happens with it. So with that, we've got another episode for you today with Fred Harrell. He's from the City Church in San Francisco. This is a story of an inclusion story for the LGBTQ community that I'm excited for you to hear. His story, his background of being a guy who was a church planter. He started this church back in the mid-90s in San Francisco and is still the pastor at this church 20 years later. And you just get to hear the journey of somebody who's been doing it for a long time and has been open to how God moves, no matter where it might take him in the journey, whether it's as a pastor or in his career or the church that he participates and leads in. So excited for you to hear his story. I think you're going to hear a father's heart in all of this and hopefully be inspired to be more open and more inclusive in your own understanding of who God is and who God is for. So with that, we're going to roll it with Fred. So let's go for it. Well, hello, friends, voices, listeners. We're excited to be dropping another episode for you today. We're hanging with a friend of mine, Fred Harrell, who is at the City Church in San Francisco. Fred, how you doing today, man?
Doing great.
Right on. Well, thanks for
glad
joining
to be
us
here.
On here. Yeah, yeah.
It's awesome.
Good to hear from you. It's been a little while, but I wanted to have Fred on here because he's got a fascinating story that I think is a story that we're going to continue to see replicated as time goes on, related to the LGBTQ conversation and that relationship with the church and a move to inclusion. So that's what we're going to talk about today. So Fred, let's start here, man. How about why don't you tell us a little bit of your own your spiritual upbringing, and then maybe just like a little bit, tell us a little bit about the history of your church and I know you started the church, so just even hear a little bit about that. Yeah. That'd be fascinating.
Sure. Well, I was born and raised in Central Florida, Lakeland, Florida, Imperial Polk County. I grew up in a city where the newspaper trucks had on the side a slogan. Found out since, and it's not actually true. it said in Polk County, we grow more orange. We grow more oranges in Polk County than the entire state of California. I used that in a sermon once, and one of my parishioners said, not so much, buddy. I've done the details. Not the case.
Of course.
But kind of an agricultural background. Dad was in agribusiness. I was actually born in a church plant. Okay. My dad was one of five or six guys who helped. It was all guys, sadly, in leadership.
It's the Southern Baptist, so that makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. But it was an awesome church, actually. In many ways, a really fresh expression of Southern Baptist life. We were at church Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, and every night in between. I never knew a day when my dad was not a deacon.
Yeah.
So, and my mom wasn't, real involved in all sorts of teaching Sunday school, all sorts of stuff. My dad taught Sunday school. So, yeah, I mean, church life was something we walked to, literally, and was just a just a very much part of who I am. And probably because of that, the upside is you become very familiar with all of it. And the downside is you become very familiar with all of it.
Right. It, yeah.
The penny may not actually really drop for you. I did the Southern Baptist stuff, which was every August, go to youth camp and rededicate your life. So it's like on my calendar, rededicate.
Get resaved again. Here we go.
Get resaved. Yeah. Get back in there. Nail those sins to the cross.
Yeah.
But those were all really formative experiences too. You know, I mean, I joke about them. But they were also good things. And I learned a lot. But I went through a kind of a pretty deep depression during my senior year of high school that lasted all the way up to the beginning of my sophomore year.
Okay.
I was an athlete in high school, and so I reluctantly went back out for football at the University of Florida. But you know, you had to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and you had to do stairs at the stadium and all that. And the reason I tell you all this is because that's the first time in my life I ever appreciated slowing down.
Okay.
As a means of reconnecting my spiritual life, my spirituality. I don't think that I really learned it well at that point, but I noticed it. Mm-hmm. Because as I quit going out every night and doing the whole party scene, and I had to go to bed, and I had to get up in the morning, and I had to run, and I had to discipline my life, and I had to be still, and I had to be just a less noisy life. I began to ask harder and better questions of who I was becoming.
Yeah.
And, and because I was raised in this Christian framework, I was asking all those questions in terms of my Christian experience up to that point. So I went home sometime that spring, went home, spring of 83, and I was starting to ask these more reflective, better questions of myself. And my mom set me up on a date with a young woman who I've never seen since. And I'm not even sure she knew she had this impact on me, but she was a really authentic, not beat you over the head with the Bible, but a really authentic Jesus follower.
Okay. Yeah.
And she talked to me that night thinking I was kind of in that same category because she knew me from years before. And, bottom line is I went home from that night in an even more deep space of like, what are you becoming?
Yeah.
There's something she's connected into that you're not accessing very well right now. Either you don't know it, or maybe you just, I think I'd rather say it just because it really wasn't accessing God at all. So that set me on to a journey of about 5 days of just really doing hard reflective work. And Easter Sunday of 83, I had another one of those big Jesus moments in my life. Like I, had a few of in junior high and senior high and so on.
Yeah.
And that began a new direction for me. In some ways, I've never really had another direction. I've been hot and cold like every other Christian experience, but it was a different trajectory from that moment on. And it's just because I ran into an authentic Jesus follower. And I think those two events, slowing down and my interaction with her, which was so organic, has really informed so much of how I understand Christian experience, ministry, philosophy of ministry.
Yeah.
And I made you to look like.
Yeah. And I think that that's so interesting in that I think oftentimes for people, they would almost say the opposite about some kind of experience with a Christian, someone following Jesus. It doesn't feel authentic. It doesn't feel like it's real or organic or meaningful. And
I have hundreds of those stories.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah. So, but how
I'm
much
sure
of an impact?
That way too sometimes, so.
Yeah.
I wanted to have conversations with people that were totally outside the mainstream, who had never been around church. And
now, up to this point, were you kind of somebody that always felt attracted more to that audience or group of people that weren't the, I mean, even if you think back to when you were a kid, I mean, in some ways I feel like the sentiment that is involved with thinking about
people that are not the church people is you do just kind of find yourself a little bit more of a skeptic or a doubter, or you're hanging on the fringes of faith. You know, I mean, does that characterize you, or were you kind of really bought into the whole belief set that you had as an SBC kid?
Yeah, it was, you know, for me, it's always been about introducing faith to other people or hearing their story. I mean, I'm an Enneagram 1, if anybody cares to know.
Yeah, we had Hewitt's on here not too long ago.
Oh, there you go. Well, he's going to be here this weekend, actually. I'm picking him up at the airport on Friday.
That's awesome.
Friday, yeah. So I'm an Enneagram 1, and my subtype is 1-1, which means I'm a reformer. I'm not a perfectionist like my desk is perfect. I'm a perfectionist like I want you to be perfect.
No pressure. Yeah, it's all
which
good.
Can really turn into me being a controlling jerk if I'm not careful. So that impulse to reform, that impulse to have engaging conversations is far more interesting to me than talking to people who are already convinced or maybe you're just not really open to a conversation.
Yeah.
That's why I think I love the campus. So what I loved about the campus is all the books were still open. People were still having conversations, but I was really only gathering people that had already made up their minds about some things in terms of their spirituality. And they liked my teaching, but I longed to do something different. I didn't know how to do it. So that's
okay.
That's how Redeemer New York City, Redeemer Presbyterian Church, Tim Keller, became such an influence in my life, because we took a group of students to New York on a mission trip for spring break. So I am as rural and agricultural country as they get background wise, scared of the city. But I had another one of those God moments. I've had like 5 of these in my life. This was like number 3, where I'm on the Weehawken Ferry. I'm coming across the Hudson and I see the skyline and I just am overcome with emotion to sit down and start crying. And the students are looking at me like, what's wrong with you? I knew this is the place that I think I'm being led. Not necessarily New York, but an urban environment.
Okay.
And what connected for me in that moment was everything I love about the campus, diversity, antagonism towards matters of faith, questions, skepticism, you know, all those kinds of electric kind of things that for me were electric and great. They were there in the city as well. And then I actually I was up till 2 o'clock in the morning with a gay man, who went to Redeemer Presbyterian Church, and he was housing students, you know, different students stayed at different members' homes, and I actually stayed at his. And I was listening to his story that night. And, you know, his story was not a story of a position where I would end up being, as I am today, as an affirming person. But it was just fascinating to hear how he was wrestling through faith in his own sexuality, but also just his own secularity. That was the main thing, actually, was how he had zero real background in the church.
Yeah.
And he had been in New York for 18 years and had radically embraced Christian faith. Well, that to me was electric. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, it's like, okay, we've got a big day tomorrow. Time to hit the hay. He says, listen, I want to tell you something before you head off for the evening. He said, I want you to know that you should be a pastor in the city. And I looked at him and said, that's all I want to do right now. That's all. He goes, well, I've been here for 18 years. I'd let you be my pastor. And I just went to bed going, Lord, what is going on here? I'm from Polk County, Florida. This is crazy. Called my wife and said, hey, honey, I think I know where we're supposed to go next. We're supposed to go to the city. And her response was, you pray about that.
Yeah. And she's like, have a good time.
I think all she could envision was like lugging children up and down subway steps in the ice and snow.
Yeah. Okay. So you have this like really meaningful experience going out to New York.
Yeah.
You're doing some stuff with on college campuses, and so then what took you to? I mean, you're talking East Coast. Your whole life's been East Coast. So then now you're in San Francisco. What happened?
What happened is the PCA asked me if I would come start a church in San Francisco.
Okay.
a guy who was recruiting for the West Coast by the name of Lewis Ruff, saw me at an assessment center type event at the current, you know, to see if, you know, the skill sets necessary for planning a church, if I had those. And he thought I was going to take some church opportunities that actually Tim Keller and some others had recruited me for. And I had said no to those because they weren't urban enough. And he found out and called me in April of 1995. And he said, I found out you're not going to the East Coast to plant a church, that you signed up for another year of campus ministry in Knoxville. And I said, yep, I did. And he goes, I want you to consider San Francisco. And it's kind of one of those moments where I was like, oh, crap. That's a long way from here.
Yeah.
And so I went downstairs, hung up the phone. This is back when you actually had phones in houses.
like tied to the wall, yeah.
Hung up the phone, went downstairs and told my wife, I said, that was Lewis Ruff. He wants us to consider San Francisco. And she just looked at me and she said, that's it.
Really?
And that's not like what she does, you know, but she's Enneagram 9. She's going to keep peace and be for slow to make decisions and things like that. And she was like, that's it. You know, that's probably it. And this is with like 1 year old draped around her ankle and a 3 year old on her hip, you know, and mass chaos. And, that's it. And so we went to look at it that summer. In August of 95, my dad was diagnosed with cancer. So we had to kind of push pause and see what that meant for him. And once we figured that out a little bit better and realized that he may not have a long life ahead of him, but it wasn't so serious that he was going to die immediately. And it'd be 7 more years till that would happen, actually. We came out and made one more visit in January and said yes in February of 96 and raised money from February to August and then landed in San Francisco August 5th with this crazy, ridiculous idea of starting a church from scratch. We had a handful of names given to us, but that's it.
Yeah, and those are the days where, I mean, you know, I've done a lot of work in church planting and now it's just like kind of everybody does it. But back then, I mean, it probably wasn't even really a thing. So people are like, wait, hold on. Yeah. You, what cult are you starting?
Yeah, exactly what they were saying. Yeah. I meet somebody and they go, oh, so you moved here from Tennessee to come save us. That's awesome.
Oh, yeah.
One of our dearest friends and has been a part of the church whenever they lived here. They've moved a few times, but now they're back, kind of retired for good. But the first time we ever met her, she said, what makes you think we need somebody like you from the South to come here and start a church? It's the first time I met her.
Yeah.
You know, and now, of course, she's like all in and has been for years. And we joke about that because it was a crazy idea. I mean, talk about a buzzkill in a conversation. So you're new to the city. What do you do? I'm here to start a new church. Oh.
Like, who invited cult. This guy?
Cult. And, you know, San Francisco in 1996 is far more antagonistic to churches and Christian faith than they are today.
Really?
And, okay. Yeah. And the reason behind that is because of the horrible track record, with the exception of the Episcopal Church, by and large, the horrible track record that the church had here, especially the Evangelical Church particularly, but really all branches except basically the Episcopals during the AIDS crisis.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And that memory was a fresh narrative in 1986 still.
Okay. So, yeah. Now, I want to get into the meat of your story of this move to inclusion. So, I think maybe what would be helpful to articulate a little bit is maybe just tell us a little bit of the dynamic of your church prior to this move.
Yeah.
Just to help the audience kind of get into that.
Yeah. So what happens is there's two parts to this. The first part is I'm in a denomination where I don't have to deal with ordination issues because I was at 6 years of campus minister, 4 years of church planner without having to have elders and deacons. So in 2000, we have elders and deacons. And in the PCA, one of the most prohibitive denominations in America regarding ordination of women, it's just zero possibility of it happening at any level. I was starting to hit a gear grind big time. And so by 2006, we left it for the RCA. the Reformed Church in America. So it's still in the Presbyterian world, but more on the Dutch side than the Scottish side. A little kinder, gentler, at least certainly back then it was. And women's ordination, we immediately became a church that had women pastors, elders, deacons, all of that, and could more fully live into our story. So I tell you all these things because I feel like my story is going from that, is constantly trying to create a table for everyone, but I kept building a temple for some.
Wow.
There's always a wall. The first wall was like making a place for everyone regardless of their belief. The second wall was making a place for everyone regardless of their gender. And so I'm constantly trying to get to the table. It's like I always felt like I wasn't quite there. And the big thing I have is the privilege of living here for 21 years. And so I have hundreds of stories that are over coffee or breakfast or lunch or in my office here, that are the stories of lives and, lives of, people who have no Christian background, lives of people that have always felt left out, lives of people that are trying on Christian faith. Again, as you well know, cities are fantastic places where people go to try to, in some ways, they go to get away from God completely. Yeah. And then find out, oh crap, I think I need God after all. Now what? And they retry on their faith again.
Yeah.
But it has to have some kind of fresh, unique expression because the old way of doing it's not going to work for them. Well, I'm a person in process myself. I think people forget this, that pastors are also, should be, on their own journey as well. Mm. And so I certainly was. I'm a person from the South who moved to San Francisco. And there's nothing wrong with saying that San Francisco has a lot and had a lot to teach me. It didn't mean that I didn't have a gift for San Francisco as well to give, but all of our places have gifts to give us as well. And the gift that I have are hundreds of stories and conversations. And it started right out of the gate. I mean, I had one idea about LGBTQ folks, which we didn't even call it that back in 1996.
Yeah.
It was an idea that now we can look at and go, oh my gosh, it's awful. But it was a prevalent view. It's the only view I'd really been exposed to, which was that people who had same-sex attraction, we didn't call it that either back then, just called it homosexuality, or you may have said gay lesbian or something like this, or people who had deep wounds that needed to be healed. And that was the source of that. And so, there's entire narratives of what I've read back in those days in the 80s and 90s about that. So when I got out here, the first person I spoke to who was gay man, I remember it was flooding outside. It was the fall of 96. We were at Perry's Diner on Union Street. This is how much it's ingrained in my memory.
Yeah.
And I have my entire paradigm for what I think is gone on in his life without me hearing a story, lesson number one, listen to people's stories.
Hmm.
And I kept fishing for a father wound. I kept fishing for a church that had been really horrible to him. I kept fishing for, the disconnect from dad and over controlling mom or maybe some kind of sexual trauma. And it was none of that. I love my dad, he would tell me. I kept going, no, really, you don't,
Yeah.
But dad's been awesome. I said, well, your dad's like a Baptist deacon. He goes like, my dad loves me. He's always loved me. He doesn't know what to do with the fact that I'm gay, but I've never experienced even an ounce of rejection. So I'm going through all of this with this person. I spent there for 2 hours talking. And I remember driving home that night saying, nothing I have learned prepared me for that conversation.
Yeah.
That was the first massive gift that San Francisco gave me, was that conversation.
Mm.
I always, every time I talk with, I was just at the Reformation Project in in Chicago, Matthew Vines' conference. And I shockingly was, I mean, I had no idea this was happening, but they gave me some kind of pastoral leadership award. So I got the microphone in my hand and I told them, I said, I'm going to tell you what I tell every group of people I get a chance to talk to when it's a gathering of LGBT folks. And it's, I'm sorry.
Hmm.
I'm sorry because it took me too long, and it did. Because that story happened in 96.
Wow. Okay.
So you take that story and you just multiply it by, 100. And, things began to shift. And it goes from clear to murky. It goes, there are cultural shifts that are taking place. Big tool in our hands for pastors was, what's now looked at as illegal in many states in the country, reparative therapy. That's been repented of or been, I'm sorry I've done this. It's by Exodus International, they've apologized for it. It's seen as horrible science. And it is. You have the accumulated stories of the fruit of the pastoral care that, I and others were giving people, and the fruit was bad. The fruit stunk. The fruit was rotten. You have, so we started a counseling center in 2008, and I purposely would not hire anyone to start the center who was remotely interested in doing reparative therapy. Even though we hadn't made any kind of official shift, that was a non-starter for our counseling center. So here we are, we haven't made a shift, but we're not doing reparative therapy anymore. We're starting to really understand sexual orientation. We don't think this happens out of a father wound or some other kind of thing. We're beginning to really get and listen to hundreds of stories of people. We have unbelievably gracious, forgiving, kind LGBT folks who are part of our congregation, even though they're in this non-affirming congregation, because I think they smell that my sermons are not matching our policy. That the welcome I was extending in my sermons and the welcome I was extending in my teaching and in my pastoral interactions, the lack of any kind of alarm going up because a person happened to be gay or lesbian, LGBT, they were sensing that while things had may not change on an official level, for a sliver of folks in this community, they were able to say, I can be here and be okay right now.
Yeah.
And they were beginning to tell me this openly. So, another great gift, for me and was, the gift of my, sophomore in college son, in November of 2010 coming out to me. And, wow. And so, I was actually telling him some things I had learned in my own therapeutic journey about my own trauma in my past. And he responded with beautifully, and he's such a beautiful human being. He said, well, since we're being vulnerable, I need to tell you that I'm gay. And, And so I reached across and grabbed him and hugged him as hard as I could and told him how much I loved him and how I'm so grateful that he told me it changes nothing. And, I'm 100 times. So here I am, a pastor of a church in San Francisco. My son's come out. My thinking is beginning to change. By the way, I have 3 other kids, all of them with needs. I have a church that's growing and it has all sorts of needs. And so life is pretty chaotic, period.
Yeah.
So there was a lot going on in our own family system at the time that needed to be attended to. Without getting into too many details about that, the bottom line is I started to read voraciously and have lots of conversations with folks. And in 2011, I believe, I was given a kind of an advanced copy of Jim Brownson's book, Gender, Bible, and Sexuality.
Yeah.
Which to my mind has never been answered. you know, to this day. And we actually had Inti right here for a weekend, and I called Jim and said, Jim, will you fly out here and let's not have a debate, but a public conversation, you and Inti Wright, to talk about your research. And he said, sure, I'll do it. I'll move heaven and earth to do it. I'll pay for the flight. Us being City Church, help him get out. And Tom Wright refused to do it.
Really? Wow.
And it's not that I don't think he's afraid or anything like that. It's just, I think Jim's work is critical. And, he comes from my denomination, my tradition, and I had all the experience arguments in the world. And for some people in their tradition, that's all they need. And I respect that too. But my tradition needed really solid Bible arguments. And
yeah,
Jim really gave that to me.
Say the title one more time, just for our listeners.
It's Gender, Bible, and Sexuality. I can't remember the subtitle. But if you Google Gender, Bible, Sexuality, and the author is James Brownson, B-R-W-N-S-O-N. He's a New Testament professor at Western Theological Seminary in Holland, Michigan, which is one of the seminaries of the Reformed Church in America, RCA.
Okay.
So Jim's book was a game changer for a lot of people. So now imagine tons of people in my tradition in the background saying, are you reading this? I'm reading this. These are huge discussion starters and conversations to be had. Now, one other thing that's happening culturally at this time. Longtime members of our church, solidly evangelical people in their backgrounds, are coming to me and saying, I've changed my mind on this.
Okay.
Can I stay in the church?
Wow.
And me responding, of course you can. This is really complicated. I understand. So those are some big shifts that are taking place. The reparative therapy, Exodus is gone. So that pastoral tool's out. Stories of increasing understanding of human sexuality. Gender science is really starting to kick in. We're starting to really do the hard work of understanding the complexities of 30 plus intersexual identities. All of this is happening. Longtime evangelicals are coming to me and saying, I've changed my mind about this. More and more Christians who are gay are feeling more empowered to speak out loud about their experience. So all of the paradigms are being broken, and people are either hunkering down or they're willing to listen and think about new possibilities about what it means to welcome these folks. And so we started a process in 2014. And yes, again, I'm sorry. It took me too long. There was a lot of stuff going on in my own family system that had to be dealt with and so on. But in the spring of 14, we started reading some books. And Gender, Bible, and Sexuality, certainly. But it's a very thick book, so not everybody wants to read that one.
Yeah.
But it's fantastic. And so we read Ken Wilson's book, Letter to My Congregation. The reason our board read that is because it was pastoral in nature.
Yeah.
And it was, how do we live together if we don't all agree about this? How do we understand this? It's a very pastoral book. It's not meant to be like Jim Brownson's book, although I think it's excellent exegetically. It's just not the same kind of book. It's written with a pastor's heart. And if you know Ken Wilson, the guy just has such a pastor's heart. He's one of the finest people I know.
Mm.
So, you know, we read that for approximately 7 or 8 months or so. And we, in March of 2015, we make a long story short, not to have to involve your audience in church politics, but we sent out a letter in March of 15. And, you know, it was an invitation to a conversation. And what I learned is that not everybody wants to have the conversation.
That's true.
Sometimes people just aren't able, you know, compassion all around. They just simply, they're not at a place that they can do that in their own development. I mean, not even have the conversation, not necessarily change your mind, but just, it's, you know, It's fascinating. So
okay, so let me ask you a question there. I mean, was that frustrating for you? How did you handle that? Because I mean, even just listening to your story right now, you have such a compassionate posture and graceful attitude with all of this. While I mean, we've maybe seen some of these stories of churches making decision like you guys have made, and it's kind of a bloodbath. You know, it's like it's just so much is going on. But for some, the way you talk about it is so much humility. So you know, as you have these people that are coming to you, like I don't even want to have the conversation. I mean. Were you like this then, or was there part of you that was like, could you not care? You know what I mean?
Yeah. It was, it was hard on them. It was hard on me. It was hard on everybody. Whenever you identify yourself with a stigmatized group of people, you take on that stigma. And mm-hmm. so for me, as a very privileged white man with money, I wasn't used to that. And I frankly needed to feel that sting that my beloved LGBTQ folks have been feeling for much of their lives, especially within the life of the church. Incredibly horrible within the life of the church. If they're not from a religious community, they don't have near as much of the rejection patterns, sadly. So, but religious communities, it's just an epidemic of skyrocketing addiction, depression, suicide.
Yeah.
It was a rejection of not only family, but from church and of God, is what they're told. So frankly, feeling that stigma was good for me. I needed to feel that, and it stung, and it was horrible. I cried myself to sleep many nights. It came in waves. People I married, people I baptized, people I led to faith, people whose babies I baptized, people whose babies are children that I buried. People who I alone are the new, this kind of the really difficult chapters and brokenness of their life, or maybe some of the horrible decisions they've made with their life. I mean, you just carry so much when you're a pastor for first of all, for this long in this one place, you know, and to be told by some who I literally led to faith, don't even bother coming to our house to talk about this. We're not interested. Wow. And I've known these people for 20 years. And I tried twice with one couple. I tried, look, you know, just give me the chance to talk to you. I haven't totally lost my mind here. I'm not going to try to convince you of anything. I just want you to hear a little bit. Don't even bother to come by. So you had different levels of rejection. You know, you had people who kind of ghosted. You just never saw them again. It's like they disappeared. Where'd they go?
Yeah.
You know, you had people who were frankly kind of nasty about it and created petitions to come after me and who had really mythological understandings of what had happened on our board. I never did feel like we had the chance to kind of tell the story and properly. We had people, again, people who, frankly were, I don't for a second think I led this, you know, well or perfectly. I've come to believe that it's almost impossible to. On such a hot topic. But, you know, so I have compassion for myself, but I also know I didn't do it right. And I didn't do it. No, Enneagram one didn't do it right. You hear that? So, I mean, I understand the criticism of my leadership. I've never told anybody, no, I didn't. I led this great. I never said that because I don't think I did.
Yeah.
And you know what? You have people that really agree with you, but then half their friends leave. So they're angry because not because of the decision, but because, you know, they used to sit with 20 people that do life together. Part of that life is church.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's like, yeah, you know, there's tons of churches for people who hold kind of these non-affirming views and are more conservative on this. And there's for straight people, but there's not a lot of churches for LGBTQ folks to come and feel safe and feel like they can bring their whole selves to church.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It was always, I mean, every day was like a, you know, I was elated and so grateful for what we were doing and so much in pain at the same time. And again, there's no group, agree or disagree. There's no group that didn't suffer to some degree in this. So I by no means am some martyr or, you know, the only person who had it tough, but probably the biggest hard spots, I'll give you two. One was my wife and I were Christmas shopping. And, no, actually, it was after Christmas, and it was in the spring. And we were shopping for a trip we were going to go on. And it's like a year or so after the letter had gone out. And a longtime member, who was one of those ones who just kind of disappeared. And it's a person who I had personally invested a ton of time in and loved her dearly, you know, and sad that she had left the church. And she saw my wife like across the hall of this mall downtown. Mm-hmm. And she looked at her and my wife was like, hey, you know, like her first instinct was to say hello, you know, and to wave. And the person looked at her. I looked at my wife and just shook her hand like, don't even think about coming over here to talk to me.
Wow.
And I'm so glad I didn't see it. I was tying my shoe at the time. I was down the ground tying my shoe. And my wife looked up and she said, did you see what just happened? I said, I didn't. And we just had to go sit down and like get a breath. And I don't know what it was about that gesture, because we had experienced tons of rejection from people, but that particular dismissing was just like a knife to the heart. And I think I probably felt it worse because it was like, felt like it was done to my spouse, you know, not just to me. Mm-hmm. The other biggest pain of all was, so there's a magazine. It's called World Magazine. Editor is Marvin Olasky. And World Magazine apparently was contacted by a group of people in our church who were upset about us becoming affirming. And so they called him to come do a story on us.
Okay.
And the story was going to be about our process, not about an argument about the issue itself.
Yep.
So I was like, well, you know, maybe I can correct some errors that he's may have been told, you know, or some misunderstandings. So I agreed to this interview about, to me, a very boring article about our church process.
And, yeah, you're like, that sounds like a thrilling read.
Yeah. Wow, can't wait. yeah, real page turner. So anyway, he comes out, we talk, and I have an elder with me, and I have a staff person who's also a lawyer with me. And so the three of us are having this conversation, and right in the middle of all of this crazy, boring conversation about our process, he says, out of the blue, he says, doesn't this really have to do with your son?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I said, so Marvin, somebody told you my son is gay. And he said, yeah. And I said, well, let me just start with by saying is that I have zero hesitation in celebrating my son and his sexual orientation. And it is not an issue at all. It is something we are glad about and love and see as a gift to us. Mm. So let's just start with that. But my son came out in 2010. This letter came out in 2015. One does not, you know, have anything to do with the other, except for, yeah, my own view of this has certainly been impacted by the fact that I have my own flesh and blood as a part of this community. I said, but to say this is about him, I said, it has nothing to do with our process. And I said, please leave my son out of this. And he said to me, the journalist in me wants to get all the facts. And I said, well, maybe the Jesus in you wants to get all the charity.
Yeah.
And he outed my son in the article.
Really?
2 months later, yeah. He had himself or some staffer troll my son's Twitter feed, where John Mark, my son, said something along the lines of, I think it was the day the new Pope Francis, when he first became Pope, said something about LGBT folks and said, you know, who am I to judge or something like that.
Yeah.
And so my son just simply said, hey, you know, the Pope thinks I'm okay or something. And then what really got me was they said in the article, it was a hard year for me that year because my son had tweeted that. And you know, it's ridiculous that they outed him. That is still a very dangerous thing to do. Gay bashing is a reality. You don't publish out people like this without, not that John Mark wasn't out, but then beyond that, to say it was a sad for me, just, and that infuriated me. And I really couldn't do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
That was a really sad day. Not to mention that I think the whole article is a hit piece, but
mm-hmm.
yeah, to realize that magazine is like on the coffee table of every, you know, everybody in my network in the state of Florida. it's more of a magazine that's read in the South. So
yeah,
that was definitely a low point.
Mm.
The high points continue to be seeing people being able to bring their whole selves to our church and to be told that they're the beloved children of God. And, you know, we have folks that have been, who are members and longtime attenders, have been married for 20 and 25 years. And honestly, they're the, you know, anybody would want the health and the beauty of their relationship and their relationship, whether they're gay or straight. And, not having to hold up those barriers anymore and finally feeling like we have what approximates a table that we can all sit at.
Mm-hmm.
And, with Jesus there with us is, this is why I always say I have not a single regret.
Mm.
And I tell every single pastor, and there are tens, maybe hundreds over the last two and a half years, that call me like Nicodemus in the night.
Me being one of them.
Yeah. Nobody knows this. What do I do? Oh my gosh, I've changed my mind.
Yeah.
I always tell myself, I won't tell you it's going to be hard, but you'll have no regrets.
Mm-hmm. You know, I remember when you said that to me. Mm-hmm. Yep, I remember.
And we lost $2 million in our budget, and we lost 30% of our attendance, and big deal in some ways. It's like, you know,
mm-hmm.
Would not change a thing in many ways. I mean, I'd try to lead better, that's for sure, but I wouldn't change the decision at all.
Yeah. One of the questions that's, I think now that I'm, what, how many, 9 months post closing our church, you know, for kind of following a similar
right.
course of action, right? You know, I've just been able to really reflect on my journey and even have some conversations with some friends. So one of the questions that's kind of lingered out there for me is, you know, like when a church makes a decision like this, I've had a couple of instances where gay people have said they almost feel like it's their fault, and it's hard for them to still be a part of that community because when they come in the doors, they feel like there's this like something hovering over them, this spotlight of like, just remember and it's not that anybody's doing that or saying that. Everybody's really supportive, but I've just wondered, like, do you have any thoughts on that? Or,
We saw the same thing. You know, it's not a person who goes to our church. They actually live in New York City, but someone I've come to know, who is gay and who is a, you know, committed Jesus follower. And I was talking about this a little bit with him, and he said, you know, in his own kind of way, he said, Fred, gay people are people too. And what he meant by that is he said, there are many categories and many, places on the, not only, personality scale, but let's say Enneagram number type, you know, evolutionary engagement, or, you know, evolved of consciousness, et cetera.
Yeah.
And some of us love to step into that setting and be the person who's helping affect the change, and knowing the church is undergoing a traumatic change, and there's a, you know, there was a packed house and now it's not a packed house, and it's because of our community. And we say, absolutely, it's because of our community. We're happy to be there.
Yeah.
But there's going to be others of us who are not ready for that journey, and we don't owe you the emotional work that it would take for us to be there. And so we may come later once the dust has settled. And so we've found three or four probably different responses among LGBT folks to our move. You know, we had folks who felt like they had to step away, and which, you know, it, on the front end, it pained me greatly. I'm like, wait, you know, we're making this sacrifice partly for your community.
Yep.
But with my friend in New York helped me understand, it's like, no, everybody's at different spots on this in terms of the, you know, what they feel comfortable being a part of. And what I love about where we are now is that that kind of energy is really not in the room anymore. The energy of transition and change and anger. And we've done a lot of hard work in the last 2 years to where now pretty much anybody from that community will feel the welcome, know the welcome. I will verbally talk about it up front every week. And I will, you know, they've read about me or they've heard sermons where I've talked about it or whatever.
Yeah.
But not everybody, including folks within that community, are ready for that journey in the same way.
Okay. Yeah.
So we've learned so much about sociology, for lack of a better term, throughout our process. But it wasn't just the sociology of, you know, straight folks who are members of our church who were trying to figure out whether they want to stay or not. It was also, you know, the varying experiences and what it means for me and my journey to feel safe at this time in this community. So I was just having this conversation recently with a married couple, a lesbian couple in our church who are just amazing. And that was their story. It was,
really?
We were here, we had to back out a little bit, and now we're fully back in. And they're now members.
That's
you know,
great.
And
so cool.
We're engaged in volunteering and all the other. So.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's really good to hear your thoughts. You know, I think I have kind of wrestled with that some because, yeah, it's the nature of what my story is. Man, dude, we're already at an hour of our conversation, bro.
All right.
And, cause I mean, there's more things that I wanted to get into. So yeah. I think there, for me, that gives me an easy ask of, hey, Fred, can we do another episode here in the next month or so? Because I think that would be really great to get into even some of the dynamics of how this has shaped your community. So we'll save that for another time.
Okay. Cool.
But I guess I appreciate your boldness and your reformer attitude to be somebody who's willing to kind of step out there as one of the first ones at a larger evangelical church to make a decision like that. Because I know, I mean, I can say for me to you, you gave me courage. Mm. To follow my gut, to live with integrity as a leader and as a pastor and to integrate myself. And, I really, you know, if I think about you and a few others that I talked to, I don't know if I could have done it if I didn't have a couple people saying, like, even just like you said, like, you'll have no regrets. You will, yeah. You won't. So
well,
I guess
likewise,
that's.
Likewise, I had people just like that for me. So that makes my day that I could be that for you. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess that's the one thing I wanted to say. And then, you know, we're going to do something called the lightning round. Is we're going to finish this thing up. Mm-hmm. You're actually the first one we're going to do this with. It was kind of like new idea that I had for the podcast that I thought just might be fun. So I'm just going to ask you a few questions. And we're looking for just short answers.
Okay.
And I only got three for today, so we'll go easy on you. And we'll start especially easy with one of them, but with the first one. So here we go.
Yep.
First thing I want to hear, and this is the Gary, the reader, who I just love reading books. What's the most impactful book you've read in the past year and why?
Boy, there's so many to choose from. Like, I just reread Brothers Karamazov this summer. And, but it's my friend Brian Zahn who inspired me to go back and read Brothers Karamazov. Because it had been a long time since I read it. So I will say, I'll say it's a Brian Zahn book because I've read every one of them. Sinners in the Hands of a Loving God. Let's say it's that one. I mean, it was just a fantastic, re-narration of understanding that we're dealing with a God who is not angry and violent and, but a God who, does not save us. Jesus does not save us from God. I think Brian would say Jesus reveals God as Savior. So it's that whole fundamental idea of the cross. From my tradition, the cross is always doing something, and I don't think it doesn't do something. But it's the cross. It's also what the cross reveals about who God is.
Okay.
So because I'm saying that, I'm also, so you can like double click that onto anything I've read about Rene Girard in the past year, anything I've read about biblical criticism in the past year, anything I've read by Pete Enns in the last year, et cetera.
I love Pete.
Yeah, Pete's fantastic.
Great. Okay, cool. Haven't read that one, so I have it on my wish list, but I just haven't read it yet.
That's awesome.
Okay, second question. And I mean, we're already talking about this in this conversation, but I'm curious if you have anything else you would add. So I'm curious if there is there a fundamental belief that you once held that you changed your mind on because you realized it was destructive, whether it's to you. I mean, obviously we're talking about the inclusion piece, but is there anything else that comes to mind with that?
Sure. You know, the way, I mean, even the way that I'm reading the Bible now versus 20 years ago is very different. When I went to seminary, I was actually taught to read the Bible differently, but I didn't listen very well.
too much drinking.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, or maybe it was just afraid, you know, to think differently.
Yeah.
But certainly, the way I understand atonement, is very much, have moved away from this angry monster God who can't dare to look at us because of our sin, which is just a complete misread of a little verse in Habakkuk about how God can't, you know, it's an appeal to God to not allow injustice to continue. Like, surely you can't look at this and think this is okay. Instead of the God we see in Jesus who, you know, encounters Zacchaeus and encounters other tax collectors, encounters the woman who is, you know, framed perhaps for adultery.
Yeah.
That's the way of putting it. So it's, you know, much more of a thank God for some of our feminist sisters who help us read these texts differently. You know, the fellow who's, you know, displaying radical kind of insanity and demon possession in the hill and the woman at the well, Jesus never looks at these people and says, oh, I can't look at you.
Yeah.
I can't look on your sin. Oh, not me. My eyes are too pure. No, we never see Jesus doing that.
Yeah.
He always moves towards them to heal and love and restore and bring about beauty. And this is what, you know, this is what bad atonement theology does to a person. It's like God can't stand to look at us. And so the only way he can look at us is if he looks at Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's really weird.
Yeah, put the Jesus lens or the Jesus goggles on, right?
Yeah. And so while I certainly have a deep love and respect at the very center of my theology is the mystery, emphasis, of the cross,
mm-hmm.
I've far more emphasized these days the death to death itself, the dealing a death blow to death of the powers and principalities. And I also emphasize this a little bit more of a Girardian understanding that what Jesus was doing there, when he says they don't know what they're doing, I think it's really true. They don't know what they're doing. They are literally caught up in a system of scapegoating. And a way to bring down the anxiety of the crowds is to find a scapegoat, kill them. And it's a temporary peace. It's not a full peace. It's a temporary peace.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus, instead of retaliating and saying, I'm coming back to crush you, says, I forgive you. And he recycles that violence into the violence of empire, into the state. He recycles that into sacral violence of that as well. It's a collusion of powers coming together. He recycles that into love, mercy, and forgiveness. I didn't say this 20 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. We had Tony Jones on here.
Yeah.
Months ago. And he talked a little bit about this when he talked about his, did God kill Jesus? Book. But, so that kind of, I mean, even leads us to our third question in some ways. So here it is. What happens when you die?
You fall into the loving, merciful hands of God. Period. Now, what do I have any idea what all the answers are about what that looks like? No. Somebody says to me, Fred Harrell, vengeance is mine, says the Lord. That's right. But don't tell me that you know what that looks like, because this is a God who turns his justice into love. And so there were 4 million surprises with the first advent of Jesus. There will be many, many surprises with the second. And I have said this since my earliest days at Reformed Theological Seminary, when I was taught this there, by my New Testament professor that everyone should be Hope So Universalist. I think we have every reason to believe that we can leave this in God's hands and it's going to be okay.
Yeah. Oh, even the way you say that, it's going to be okay. That's good.
It's going to be okay. God's going to work this out. Yeah.
Oh man. All right, D. Well, let's wrap this up. How about you just tell us a little bit, maybe where we can learn more about your work that you do and your church and,
Sure.
Yeah.
So, citychurchsf.org. You need to put in the SF part, and you need to put in the ORG part, or it goes to a couple of different other churches. Some poor guy in Houston is constantly emailing me saying, "Hey, I think they got the email address wrong again." So it's citychurchsf.org. So that's where you can get our podcasts that come out every week, usually by Monday morning. You can also read more about us on the website. You can read about us at some of our auxiliary ministries that we've begun. One is called the Newbigin House of Studies. So newbiginhouse.org, where we have a 9-month fellows program for lay folks. We have a Newbigin year that gives you advanced standing in a seminary. So it's an entire year for probably a pre-seminary year for people who are wanting to try it out. But you could certainly do the Newbigin year in the middle. It's named after Leslie Newbigin, who was a great missiologist and a thinker and created the Church of South India. Another story altogether. He's been deceased many years, but is brilliant. And or you can read about us at City Hope San Francisco as well. I'm not sure. I think it's called cityhopesf.com or .org. You could just certainly Google it, where we have a 7-day-a-week community development center called City Hope, which is in the heart of the Tenderloin, which is a neighborhood of addiction and homelessness in our city. And you can also read about an SRO, a single resident occupant hotel, which are kind of unique to San Francisco, where we have 37 residents, I think it's 37, men and women who are on a 2-year program of kind of being on the second half of the 12 steps and are integrating their way back into the world.
Wow.
Yeah. So you can read all about us online. I haven't written a book, probably will, but pushed all that kind of stuff to, you know, probably now and beyond in my life. The bread and butter of my life is honestly, it's daily pastoring. I love the grind. I love meeting with people. And so, yeah, I haven't written a lot.
Yeah.
I tweet a lot. People say, most people think, yeah, way too much. But again, yeah. I'm reforming the world. What am I supposed to do? Sit here and do nothing?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Right on, man. Dude, well, thanks so much for hanging with us. And I'll be sure to get you on to talk about some other stuff that I think you guys are addressing within your community. So I guess with that, we'll see everybody next time.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Voices Podcast. If you want to get the links for anything we talked about today, they will be in the show notes on patreon.com/voicespodcast. If you go there, you can scroll down to the episode and you will see all the links right there.
And if you're interested in becoming a supporter of the show, we are on Patreon. So you can go to our Patreon website and you'll see different levels of supporting the show. That helps us to get different guests on the show, put more time and resources to this. And one of the things we want to do is be a resource to you on your spiritual journey. That was the whole vision behind this in the first place. So one of those ways we do that is at different levels, there are different resources that we'll make available to you as you are working through reimagining faith.
We also want you to be able to join the conversation with us. So make sure you leave us a comment on Facebook or tweet at us on Twitter. We are Voices Podcast on Facebook and at Voices Pod on Twitter. Let us know what you thought, agreed with, disagreed with, and what you want to hear more about.
All right. Thanks for listening.